Okay, so I called this teaching the Passover in Genesis. And if you think about it, if I said the word Passover and you had to think of a book of the Bible, it wouldn't be the book of Genesis. It'd probably be the book of Exodus, because that's where you have the Israelites leaving Egypt, and we'll read a little bit in there. But I wanted to kind of put a little bit of a twist on this, because I thought it was interesting. There was a couple of Jewish commentaries I read where you'd be reading a specific event about the patriarchs, and they would say this is on Passover. And I don't know how many of you have ever delved into Jewish commentaries and Midrash at all, but at times you almost think they're crazy, because there's absolutely times you just think they're just saying something to say something. But what I found with the Passover in Genesis is that if you actually studied a little bit and looked into the reasons why they were saying these things, there were really some quite incredible things going on in the text. So I wanted to begin ahead, I should say, in Paul's epistle to the Romans. We'll go Romans chapter 3. And the thing about Romans, we're going to kind of jump right in the middle, but it seems like Paul is always like, he's saying circumcision doesn't matter, and then all of a sudden he's saying it does matter, and then he says, you know, he seems to say something against the Torah, against the law, and then all of a sudden he says, you know, God forbid the Torah be abolished. So we're going to catch him right in the middle of one of these kind of things where he's going back and forth. He's going to be talking here about the advantage of the Jewish people. So in Romans chapter 3 and verse 1, he says, then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision? Circumcision is, he's just saying the same question. Those who were circumcised in the ritual sense were Jewish. He says, then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. And so when he talks about the oracles of God, he's alluding back to the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. So the Torah was given to the Jewish people, and the festivals were given to Israel. They're given to the Jewish people. And what he says is that they were entrusted with these things. They were keeping these things. I mean, if you think about the past 2,000 years, since the time of Messiah, who have been the ones primarily keeping the festivals of the Torah? It's been the Jewish people. Who have been keeping the commandments of the Torah primarily? It's been the Jewish people. They're the ones who are entrusted with this. They're the ones who have been carrying these things. And they're also the ones who are supposed to be a light to the nations and then sharing these things with the entire world. So when we think about the Torah and we think about the festivals, we think about them being given at Mount Sinai. You think, particularly when you think about the festivals, you think about Leviticus 23. I like to say that's kind of the laundry list of all the festivals. If you ever want to learn about the festivals, go to Leviticus 23. It just goes down all the different festivals. You can find that again in Numbers chapter 28 and 29. It was a little bit more boring because it goes into all those different sacrifices. It's not as glamorous as Leviticus 23, I think. You can laugh at that. But Passover is unique because it is the one festival where the instructions are given before Mount Sinai. Almost all of the detailed instructions about Passover are given before the giving of the Torah proper at Mount Sinai. So let's look at these instructions. Go back to Exodus chapter 12. And so remember, this is, you've had the nine plagues, and Pharaoh's heart has been stubborn, and he does not want to let Israel go. And so basically, in Exodus chapter 12, God is going to announce the 10th and final plague, the death of the firstborn. But this is the first plague where Israel actually has to do something. In the other plagues, they either kind of were affected a little bit by the plague, or they were protected by God. But in this case, they actually have to do something. And so he gives very detailed instructions. So I want to read just a little bit of this. So in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 1, it said, "The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, 'This month shall be for you the beginnings of months. It shall be the first month of the year. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his nearest neighbor shall take according to the number of persons, according to what each can eat. You shall make your count for the lamb.'" And so it goes on, talking about the lamb is to be unblemished and exactly how you're supposed to cook the lamb and when you're supposed to eat the lamb. And the instructions are very, very detailed, and we would expect to be, because this is not just instructions for celebrating a festival. This is a life and death thing. If you didn't do this right, the angel of death was not going to pass over your door. But what's interesting is in verse 8, we have unleavened bread introduced. And it says, "They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted on the fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They shall eat it." What's interesting, and a lot of Bible commentators have pointed this out, that unleavened bread, which in Hebrew is the word matzah, is introduced without any explanation. There's no detailed instructions about how to make matzah. There's no instructions about exactly, you know, what are the ingredients, what should it look like. It just all of a sudden shows up. Like, you should know what it is. You're going to eat the Passover with matzah and maror, which is bitter herbs. And it's curious. And I was reading one commentator, and he's not a rabbinical commentator. He's a scholarly commentator. And he says that what he thinks that this shows is that somehow that matzah, the practice of eating matzah, was already known. That this isn't something that's introduced new here. It's something that was already perhaps being observed, or people knew about already. So in these instructions, God could just mention matzah and the Israelites would know exactly what he was talking about already. So that kind of, you know, first, Passover is this kind of strange holiday because it's given before the Torah, before Mount Sinai. But then we read here that there are aspects of the festival that appear like they existed even before these instructions are given. And so what I want to do then is, with this kind of background, is go into Genesis and see if we can see the festival of Passover being observed and existing. But let's begin all the way back at the beginning. Let's begin with the creation account. In Genesis chapter 1, it's amazing when I have people approach me and they say that they would like to be a Bible teacher, what's the most important thing? And I always, even though I haven't mastered them myself, I think the most important thing is to learn the original languages, because there's so much that we miss when we read our Bibles in English. We just don't know what's going on, because, you know, Hebrew, take the language of Hebrew, it's so multifaceted. There's so many different levels of interpretation for words and connotations that we miss it in English. So let's read Genesis chapter 1 and verse 14. This is a case of that. It says, "And God said, 'Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. And let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be as lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth.' And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light to the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. There was evening, there was morning, the fourth day." Now, when we read that in English, it basically sounds like God creates all these heavenly spheres. Now, we could get into this other interesting complication, that if God is now creating the sun, the moon, and the stars, what in the world was he creating when he said, "Let there be light"? What was that? But that's a whole nother question. So But when we read this, it basically sounds like you could say, well, yeah, he's just creating the seasons, winter, spring, summer, fall, and that the all these things in the heavens, you know, they give the different seasons of the year. But when we look at this in Hebrew, we come away with a different idea. That word there for seasons is the word moed. Moed. In plural, right here, it would be moedim. And it comes, and moed means a set, appointed time. It comes from a root word that means to set or to designate. Now, we won't do it here, but if you would go to Leviticus chapter 23, what we were talking about before, where it says, where God says, these are the appointed times that you shall keep. He's appointed times there, again, is that word moedim, moed, the festivals. The interesting thing is that in the English translations of our Bible, this is the only case in all of the Torah and all of the first five books of the Bible, it's the only case where the word moedim is translated in most Bibles as seasons. Every other case, it's translated as festivals. So it's almost as if this, you know, such an important thing going on here in Genesis, and it's obscured in most English translations. This is the first time the word moedim is used. They translate it as seasons, and then the rest of the time that it's used in the Torah, it's always festivals. And I would propose that we should translate this here as it is translated in the rest of the Torah, as festivals. So that means, before Mount Sinai and the giving of the Torah, and before even instructions about the Passover, all the way back in creation, God is already establishing his festivals and his appointed times. And to me, it's very significant, because you think about this, that from the very, you know, from the in the very blueprint of creation, in the very DNA of creation, are these appointed times where God desires to meet with his people. You think of this, thousands and thousands of years ago, God already wrote on his, I used to teach this and say BlackBerry or your little black book, I don't know. He put on his iPhone, that he wanted to meet with his people at these specific times. I wish we had time to go through all of the creation and really the first couple chapters of Genesis, because so much is established, so much of what is expanded upon later on is established there in Genesis. And so what's exciting to me is, yes, the festivals were given first, in a sense, to the Jewish people, to the nation of Israel at Mount Sinai, but already back here in Genesis, we see that the intention of those festivals was that they would be universal. That and indeed we see in the prophets, it talks about that all these festivals are going to be basically celebrated by all of mankind. So with that in mind, festivals in general, we see that being established. Let's now focus on Passover. So let's go to the narrative of Cain and Abel. Now, I want to just take a minute and define two terms so that we're all on the same page, because I'm going to be referring to these two things quite a bit, and I just want everybody to understand what I'm talking about. So the first term is Midrash, when we say Midrash. Midrash can mean a variety of different things. In fact, you know, if we were in a discussion in this room about a text of the Bible, that could be considered a midrash. Midrash is basically discussing and expanding upon the Bible. But there's a body of literature in rabbinic literature called midrash, where the Jewish sages will look at different words in the text, and they'll expound upon them. They'll sometimes they create fanciful stories about what happened to kind of fill in the gaps of where, you know, when we read a narrative and we think, gee, you know, what did Cain do after he killed Abel? Well, the Midrash might fill in a story that, you know, he went to Starbucks and got a coffee and felt convicted on the way or something like this. And there's often parables in there, but what we're going to do is we're going to be looking at the Midrash as it talks, because Genesis doesn't come right out anywhere and say this took place on Passover, but the Midrash oftentimes will say this took place on Passover. So we're going to be kind of digging into the Midrash and examining some things that the rabbis said, and we're not taking that as authoritative. We're using that as a tool. We're looking at the sages of Israel who have studied the Bible for thousands and thousands of years and saying, I bet we could learn something from them, you know, as opposed to, you know, someone like myself who hasn't even been studying Torah for 50 years. So that's what Midrash is. And you know, some people get caught up because they'll look at Midrash and they read these crazy stories and they think, well, that the rabbis really think that's true. Oftentimes it's just a parable to teach a lesson, or there's something, and we'll look at that. The second term that we'll be talking about is called the Targum, or the Targums. Okay, everybody in here familiar with the Bible called the Message? Have you heard of this? Mm-hmm. Yes, the Message is this. It's a translation of the Bible, but it is very paraphrased. Right? They not only seek to translate, like, let's say, the Hebrew of the Old Testament, but they want to throw in some of their own interpretation along the way. The Message, we could say, is an English Targum. What the Targums were, when the Jewish people back in the Second Temple period, when a lot of them only spoke Aramaic or didn't know Hebrew that well, they translated the Bible into Aramaic. But a lot of times, rather than just translating the Bible, they would also throw in some interpretations along the way. So, if they felt like something was alluded to in the Bible, but they wanted to make it explicit, they would make it explicit in the Aramaic Targum. So a lot of times in a synagogue, the Targum would be read aloud to people and would help them understand the Bible, you know, hear the Bible in their language and also get some interpretation. But what the Targums do for us is they allow us to see how the Jewish people understood the Bible in the time of Messiah, because we can understand, you know, it's not, like I said, it's not just a translation, but there's also some interpretation. So we're going to be looking at the Targum on Genesis in a couple places. If you're interested in its technical name, we're going to be looking at Targum Pseudo-Jonathan, but I'm primarily just going to say the Targum. So let's look at this story about Cain and Abel. I'm sure we're all familiar with this. This is, if you're raising kids, this is probably every parent's worst nightmare that something like this happens. But we see that, you know, when man comes out of the garden and out of that, in Hebrew it's Gan Eden, paradise, that immediately they're in this fallen state. And so we have a little issue here, to say the least. So let's read Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1. It says, "Now Adam knew Eve his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell." Now obviously we know what happens after this. Cain murders Abel. Cain receives a curse. Cain begs God to have mercy on him. God puts a mark on Cain and has a bit of mercy, and there's some retribution there. We always wonder every year when I teach a Torah class, what the Genesis doesn't tell us exactly explicitly what was wrong with Cain's offering. Why wasn't Cain's offering? If we take it on a face level, it's kind of hard to tell. But when there's a vacuum, of course, the rabbis start talking and they start trying to figure out. So what's interesting is if we look at the Targum, well, first of all, let me say in verse 3, where it says, I have the English Standard Version, it says, in the course of time. And that's the way the English Standard Version translates it. Literally, it says there, at the end of days. At the end of days. Implying that something has been fulfilled. Something is going on here. And so, in the Targum, this is what it has for verse 3. It says, and it was at the end of days, on the 14th of Nisan, that Cain brought of the produce of the earth the seed of flax, an offering of the first things before the Lord. The 14th of Nisan is the 14th of the first month, which is the eve of Passover. And so the Targum imagines that this event is taking place on Passover. Why were Cain and Abel, you know, there's a vacuum, what's going on here? Why are Cain and Abel offering sacrifices? The Targum, ancient Jewish interpretation, sees that this was Passover. In fact, there's a Midrash that takes this even further. It says, the evening of the festival of Passover arrived. Adam called his sons and said to them, in this night, in the future, Israel will bring Passover offerings. Bring you also Passover offerings before your Creator. So, essentially, so the sages thought, why are they offering? They're offering Passover offerings. They're offering of the first fruits. Now, how in the world do the rabbis come up with at the end of days, and how do they arrive at Passover? Okay? Now, bear in mind, this is going to be the most complicated portion of the night, and everything else is going to be a lot easier to understand. So if you don't get this, don't worry. It's just details. But I thought I'd share with you how they get that, the end of days. So in Jewish thinking, there are actually two different thoughts about when the world was created. When, you know, because in Jewish thought, every important event in the Bible takes place on a certain date or on a festival. Nothing is random. And I kind of like that thinking. And so there's two thoughts about when was the world created. One is that the world was created in Nisan, which is the first month, the month of Passover, and that will take place here in April. Usually it takes place in the spring. So there's one thought that the world was created that the world was created in Nisan, and then there's another view that it was created just a few days before the month of Tishri, which is the seventh month. That's the month you have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay? So if you take this end of days thing, right? So just bear with me just for a moment. So if you have the first month, okay? If the world is created on the first day of the first month, that means man is created on the sixth day of the first month. Everybody got that? There are some people that interpret that phrase at the end of days as referring to a week, okay? So if you take the world's created on the first day, man is created on the sixth of Nisan, then you add at the end of days, which is a week, then you have the 13th, and then it says after the end of days, what day is that? The 14th. So that's how you arrive at Passover. The other theory is a bit more of a stretch, I think. This one's even a stretch. I don't know how somehow they have Cain and Abel developing quite fast, because at the most they could have been at that point a week old. But I don't know. I don't know how all that works. But the other theory, okay, so if you take the seventh month, right, and that's in the fall, and they say if the world is created in the seventh, if man is created in the seventh month, that phrase at the end of days refers to the change of seasons into spring, which takes place around the time of Passover. So I feel that I like that the sages put Passover here, but I feel it's a little bit of a stretch. It's kind of some exegesis. There's a lot of evidence that the ancient Jews believed this took place at Passover, but I feel like it's not going to be as convincing as an example as a few that I want to show you in just a minute. Now, I wish we had time because the rabbis and the Targums actually have a whole bunch of stuff happening on Passover. Jacob's, you know, when Jacob is going to bless Esau and, when Isaac is going to bless Esau and Jacob, you know, fools him with the garments. I never noticed this before until I took a look at this in the context of Passover. It says that he was asked to get two young kids for the meal. And the sages asked, why two young kids? Well, they were for, they fit in the qualifications of the Passover offering. So it's thought that Isaac's blessing over Jacob took place at Passover. There's a thought, and I wish we had time to go into this symbolism, that the binding of Isaac took place on Passover, which is really a tremendous thing because you look at all the symbolism that the binding of Isaac points to towards Yeshua and his sacrifice. I think it's very significant that that's thought to have taken place on Passover. But there's a couple others. When I was studying for this, I started to get overwhelmed, and I thought, well, I'm going to present the Cain and Abel one, and then I'm going to kind of present to you what you'll see is, I feel, is a kind of a convincing narrative that gets more convincing as it goes along. So let's move on from Cain and Abel, and let's go to Genesis chapter 17 and the circumcision of Abraham and his household. So obviously, this is where God promises that Abraham will have a son, that Isaac will be born. This is where the covenant takes place. And this is the covenant of circumcision. This is the first time in the Torah where the commandment of circumcision is given. So if you look at Genesis chapter 17 and verse 23, it says, "Then Abraham took Ishmael his son and all those born in his house, or bought with his money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskins that very day as God had said to him." Now, if you look, that you have that expression there, "that very day," and then you have that expression again in verse 26, "that very day." And I think in the most literal sense, it means that the day that God said, "circumcise your household," that Abraham had himself and his household circumcised. But once again, looking at the Targum, they take that phrase, "in that day," or "that very day," or "that same day," and they have this once again taking place on Passover. Now, what's interesting is Passover, right, is the only festival where in order to eat the Passover sacrifice, you have to be circumcised. It's the only one. And in fact, and it says later in Exodus, it says that, you know, to eat of the Passover, you have to be circumcised. And if the sojourner who's sojourning with you, if he desires to eat the sacrifice, he wants to participate in a Passover, he has to be circumcised. And so it's an interesting kind of connection that the sages would put this with Passover. But as you'll see, as the narrative goes on, there starts to show up some interesting clues. So when you read this in a Torah cycle, that narrative is the end of one Torah portion, and then Genesis chapter 18 begins a new Torah portion. So they're often separated. But the rabbis see this as kind of one continuous event. If you'll notice, those of you that have more literal translations of Genesis chapter 18, it says, it starts out with, "and the Lord appeared to him." Now, what's interesting is that it does not feel it needs, keep this in mind, if you were starting a new chapter, like let's say one of your kids are writing a book for school and they're writing a new chapter, when you start a new chapter, you have to reintroduce the subject. You don't say, so in this case, you see it says, and the Lord appeared to him. It doesn't say, and the Lord appeared to Abraham. There's the and which connects it, and it assumes almost that it's just a continuous narrative. We're still talking about Abraham here. No need to, even though it's a new chapter, no need to introduce anything new. And so the sages believe that this is one continuous flow. So we know Abraham is there sitting outside of his tent. These three visitors come. Again, another thing would be fun to talk about. We don't have time. Who were these visitors? What do they represent? But these three angels come, and so Abraham, and you know, displays extraordinary hospitality. He calls the angels, you know, and the sages believe he's still in that pain of having that circumcision operation, and he calls the angels to him, and he convinces them to stay, and he fixes them a meal, and he has their feet washed. It's interesting. He says, stay while I bring you a morsel of bread, and then he ends up giving them a feast. And there's a proverb in Judaism that says, say little and do much. It's better to promise a little and do a lot more than to promise a lot and do very little. So, but there's an interesting thing in here. There's a couple of things that we pick up on if we examine the Hebrew. So if you go to verse 6 of Genesis chapter 18, remember we're still in that kind of continuous narrative, it says, and Abraham went quickly into the tent to Sarah and said, quick, three seahs of fine flour, knead it and make cakes. And in Hebrew, the word there for cake is uga. And it implies thin wafers. It's not regular bread. It's very thin wafers, which in Jewish thought, it was believed that this was unleavened bread. We're actually going to see, I'll give you a prelude, but we're going to move from here into the Lot story. We're going to see that the Torah explicitly says that when the angels come and visit Lot, that Lot gives them matzah. We'll talk about that in a minute. So there's this unleavened bread he's serving him. And of course, this is so they come and they announce that at this time next year that Sarah will have a child and his name, you know, Isaac is coming, and then Sarah laughs, and the angels confront her, and she says she didn't laugh, and you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the story. But if you go down again, this is another case where when we look at the Hebrew, we're going to see something different. Go down to verse 10. So this is one of the angels talking, or you know, this kind of goes back and forth between the Lord and the angel. So it says, the Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and your wife shall have a son. And where it says, this time next year, again, literally in the Torah, it says, at the time of life, which can be interpreted as, again, in the spring. Okay? So where here it says, so we could say, we could interpret this, I will surely return to you this time next year in the spring, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And the Jewish sage, Rashi, here's what he said about this verse. He says, at this time next year, he says again, it was Passover, and on the following Passover, Isaac was born. Since it does not say at a time, but it says at this time, a specific time. Now, go down to verse 14. Here's where I think it really starts to get interesting. Verse 14, so this is after Sarah laughs, and the Lord asks Abraham why Sarah laughs, and he says, is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. What do you think that word is in Hebrew for appointed time?
It's moed.
It's moed. Again, referring to the feasts. And if we look in the if we looked in the Targums again here, it says the Targums interpreted this, what they said, at the festival. So in the Targums in Aramaic, it doesn't just say appointed time. They interpret it as the festival. And in fact, in the Talmud, it says, this is how they translate it literally, on the next festival, I will return to you. In other words, on Passover. So we know from this point then that, and the narrative is continuing, then we have the where the Lord privately goes to Abraham and says that he's going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham does that kind of interceding, bargaining thing, and he gets it down to 10. I always wondered in that story, why did Abraham choose to stop at 10? You know, I probably would have just kept going till I got yelled at. But he decides, he stops at 10. He probably figures, surely there's 10 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah. But he was wrong, right? But so then these angels, they come and they go and they visit Sodom and Gomorrah. And again, this is all taking place kind of one continuous narrative. And I don't know how many of you had a chance to see the Bible on the History Channel that made that? Did you guys have a chance to see that? If you didn't, don't watch it, because this scene will be ruined, because the angels were like these kung fu masters in the... they pulled out swords, and it's a long story, but... So it says in verse 3, it says, but he pressed, so of course, Lot sees these angels, knows what goes on here in the evening, knows the trouble that goes on in Sodom. Lot is there. Lot says, you know, hey, you guys need to stay with me. I can protect you. And it says, so it specifically says, in verse 3, but he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. And that is the word matzah in Hebrew. Once again, these kind of little clues. And so, once again, all, you know, sages and various midrashes and commentators, they all are insisting that this took place on Passover. Now, what I thought was interesting is I found an article online by a rabbi from Israel, and his name is Rabbi Yoel ben Noach, and he himself was trying to figure out why would the rabbi say that this took place during Passover. And he said, you know, just because matzah's served doesn't mean it's on Passover. What he actually discovered is, if we look at the Lot narrative, it is a Passover narrative. Some of the very same things that take place in the Exodus from Egypt take place in this escape from Sodom and Gomorrah. So, for instance, it tells you that on Passover, that first Passover in Genesis chapter 12, it says that they're not allowed to go out of their house. And in the case of Lot, Lot opens his door, which it said was shut, and he tells them to come in, and he shuts the door behind them. In both cases, there's the eating of unleavened bread. In both cases, angels come to the door. In the Passover, you have the angel of death, right, that brings destruction and something miraculous. And here you have these angels who come to the door, but they also do something miraculous. Remember, they blind the people and they take them away. In both cases, in Exodus chapter 12 and in Genesis 19, the angels tell him that he's going to destroy the city and that they need to get out. In Exodus chapter 12, God says that he's going to bring destruction upon the firstborn of Egypt. Here in verse 14 of Genesis chapter 19, it says, So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, up and get out of this place. That's the exact same phrase in Hebrew that God says to Moses. Get up and get out. And it's very significant because that's a key phrase in the Passover narrative. And in both cases, here in Genesis chapter 19, when the dawn comes, the angels take Lot and his family and take them out of Sodom. In the Exodus narrative, when the morning comes, Israel leaves Egypt. The angels tell Lot, they tell him not to linger, that he's got to keep moving, and the angels almost have to kind of grab Lot and take him out of there because he's so stunned. In the Exodus narrative, it says that God, he brought them out of Egypt so quickly, right? They couldn't have haste. They had to have their loins girded, that they didn't have time for their bread to rise. If you even look at this, there's even a connection with the plagues, because God rains down fire and hail and all this stuff onto Sodom, and you have the plague of hail in the Exodus narrative. And I thought what was really interesting is that this rabbi ties this all together at the end, because he says that the duration of the whole event with Lot is from night until the morning. And the same is with the Exodus from Egypt. The events take place as soon as evening comes till the morning. And what do you have in Genesis 19? You have Lot's family is saved, of course, except for his wife. And you have the birth of the nations of Moab and Ammon. And in the Exodus from Egypt, you have Israel is saved from Egypt, and you have the birth, really, of the nation of Israel. That's when they really become a nation, coming out of Egypt. And I thought, I mean, it's so incredible to me that you see all these kind of hidden clues woven in here, but you see that God creates an Exodus experience for Lot before the Exodus from Egypt. And it all seems to take place around this time of unleavened bread. I kind of have a theory that maybe before the Exodus 12, where it talks about the Passover sacrifice, maybe that there was some type of festival that was orally taught to maybe, I don't know, Adam in the Garden of Eden, where they would have a week-long period of unleavened bread. And then in the Exodus 12 narrative, you have the addition of the Passover sacrifice. It's interesting because today, if we would say Passover's coming up. And what we mean by Passover is we mean the Seder, we mean the week of unleavened bread, and we mean all that it entails. But in the earliest days of Israel, you really have two separate events. You have Chag HaMatzot, which is the festival of unleavened bread, which lasts 7 days. And Passover was not that festival. Passover is specifically the sacrifice. Pesach in the Torah, Passover, Pesach, is a technical term just for that sacrifice. So that is added. It seems that's added on in Exodus. And in Genesis, you have some kind of unleavened bread celebration. I thought I would even read you this interesting liturgical hymn that's found in the Jewish prayer book and that is read and prayed and sung on the second day of Passover. So here are the words. It says, "To the Oriental Abraham, you revealed the future midnight of Passover. At his door you knocked in the heat of the day on Passover. He satiated the angels with matzah cakes on Passover, and he ran to the herd, symbolic of the sacrificial beast of Passover. The Sodomites provoked God and were destroyed by fire on Passover. Lot was withdrawn from them, and he baked matzot at the time of Passover. So every year, this is kind of this Passover in Genesis is ingrained in the Passover liturgy. And I thought, what does, if this is true and this really is a Passover, and maybe some of the other events that we didn't have time to talk about do represent a Passover in Genesis, what significance is it to us? Well, I think it shows to me what I learn over and over in the Torah, that God is an orderly God. Oftentimes when I grew up, to feel that you had the, you know, to really be spirit-filled meant that everything was disorderly. That's kind of, you know, that's how we imagine. If God was really involved, then it was crazy. But if there was order, then the spirit was quenched. But what we learn over and over is that God is a God of order, that he has these appointed times, like we read in Genesis chapter 1. He has these appointed times, these moedim, ahead of time, already planned, what's going to take place, when he wants to meet with his people. As I said, I think that these moedim, these appointed festivals, are really in the blueprint of creation. And they're really, I wish we had time to talk about, because there are very significant times where God wants to teach us certain principles. Passover specifically is a time of focusing on the divine mercy of God, redemption, and fulfillment of his promises. And it's also interesting to me that while you have him singling out Israel and making them the chosen people and giving them the Torah and giving them these festivals, that he also intended these festivals to be observed by all mankind, by all who would call upon the name of the Lord. And specifically, I think all of us who are disciples of Messiah. These aren't just symbolic pictures of the past, but they're pictures of what's going on now. And, you know, we can look at the, you know, perhaps we can look at that Passover type narrative in Cain and Abel, and we can look at that Passover type narrative with Abraham and his circumcision and the angels visiting, and then with Lot. And then we look at the Passover that took place in Egypt, and then we look over at the Passover that took place with Messiah. But the prophets tell us that there will also be a greater Exodus coming again in the future. Well, God will not just take Israel out of one nation like Egypt, but out of the four corners of the earth and ingather them back to Israel to set up the kingdom of heaven, to set up the Messianic era. And it's exciting to me that a big part of that Messianic era that we read in the prophets is that all of mankind will be celebrating these festivals. And there will be blessings and cursings, you know, like with tabernacles. If you don't celebrate tabernacles, you're not going to have rain. All of the nations of the world will be doing these things and will be learning these things. And to me, it's incredible to see how orderly God is. And it's incredible to see, when we really do get a hold of the Torah, all these little secrets and kind of nuggets that are hidden in the text that show us what a great God we have and how incredible his word is.